Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob, for this very special collaboration with the National Portrait Gallery for the LGBTQ plus History Month?
I'm feeling incredibly proud, and I really enjoyed our little chat that we had. And it was really fascinating to explore some of the heroes, both of yours and mine, who happen to also be in the National Portrait Gallery collection. And throughout this LGBTQ plus History Month and beyond, the National Portrait Gallery are going to be sharing stories and portraits of all of those that have helped shape Britain.
Amazing. Please enjoy this episode. Please support the National Portrait Gallery. And you can go online and you can look up all the artists that we discuss in this week's episode and also learn more about our queer history and who's part of the collection.
Yeah, and the best bit is during this lockdown, you can still stay connected with the gallery. You can follow them on social media, their Instagram and Facebook. It's at National Portrait Gallery. And they're also on Twitter at NPG London. And you can head to the NPG website, which is www.npg.org.uk. Thanks, National Portrait Gallery.
Thank you very much.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, Russell.
Look at you in your gold chain. What's that for?
I'm just turning really bling lately.
You are bling lately. It's really interesting that we are here today and you've turned bling, because we are talking about the bling collection of LGBTQI plus queer artists that are in the National Portrait Gallery collection.
Yeah, and you know why? Because it's LGBTQ plus History Month.
Woo! Happy LGBTQI plus History Month to you, Rob.
Yeah, and to you. And both of us are obviously part of the LGBTQI plus community.
Yes.
And we've also spoken to numerous guests on our podcast, Talk Art, over the years, who are queer as well, which has been a really fascinating journey for us, because I think we've learned a lot about ourselves throughout our lives from our teenage years onwards. I think we've often felt a real solidarity and connection to great artists. And the National Portrait Gallery collection has many amazing photographs and portraits and paintings by queer, gay, LGBTQI plus artists. So I'm really excited today to chat about some of those.
Same. But we streamlined four down, which are pretty well-known, but really great to talk about and go a bit more in depth with. Because as you were saying, yes, there are a lot of queer artists that have contributed to National Portrait Gallery, but a lot of queer people have also sat for portraits that are in the National Portrait Gallery. So there is a massive broad stretch. But today we're going to concentrate on four artists that we really connected to and love. And I guess we should probably start with Maggie Hambling, who I think is just... We both think he's just a powerhouse. What a personality. Like, the art, of course, phenomenal. But just as a personality, just as a force of nature, Maggie Hambling is incredibly forthright and solid and proud, proudly queer, proudly... Like, everything she does with such an authority and such a confidence, which I absolutely love. But we were looking at a photo, a painting that was done by Maggie, which is called Maggie Hambling, by Maggie Hambling, from 1977 to 78 it took her to paint that. Do you know that painting, Rob?
I love that painting. And it's actually, I think, one of my favourite works by her, because I really like the composition with all the interior kind of objects, and it becomes this kind of portrait made up of many different elements. Yeah. And it's quite dreamlike. And you've definitely got that element of her expressive kind of painterly vision, because she does have a very unique, you know, way of making paintings that I don't think many artists have. It's like a very Maggie Hambling look.
Yeah.
But that work has references to kind of more traditional portraiture and even still life, kind of interior domestic scenes, but with her kind of the way that the objects will often kind of start to merge or become quite fluid and quite kind of, you know, melting almost in the image. And I love that about her imagery.
I always think that sometimes your objects, the things you own, can kind of tell you who you are. If they're gifts from people, for example, it kind of tells you what personality outwardly people think you have, but also it defines you. And these objects are also seem very personal to her narrative. And I don't know if you realize, but she's painted herself with three arms.
Yes.
She feels like she has to contain everything and it doesn't feel like she's got enough arms, but her main priorities are her paintbrush, her cigarettes and her booze. She yes. loves her drink, her cigarettes and her paintbrush. Obviously, they're the three driving forces in her life. So she's given herself three arms to contain those. But what's really exciting about this painting is that there is a queer element in there. And there is a quote which I found where she says that, so it's a very queer element, but you'll see the teapot that's floating through, the ceramic teapot. And then in the bottom right-hand corner, there's this kind of essence of someone, like it looks like the figure of a female from behind or the side, like a profile. But she says that spiritually she's in love with the person who made the teapot for her, but physically she's in love with the person whose persona we just glimpse in the bottom right hand corner. So this, it's coded and loaded, and I love that about it, because as an audience you don't know that you're aware that you are actually consuming a queer authentic life being lived. And that's, and it's like through these messages, you know, 1977, 78, we're still early days really for, you know, queer lib, for like acceptance, like all the laws and everything in our part of the world. And this feels like a really beautiful way of her kind of signaling to her community and signaling her own interior.
Yeah, definitely. And there's also other works in the National Portrait Gallery collection by Hambling. There's an amazing portrait of Dorothy Hodgkin. And in that one, you see like four or five hands. She's kind of at a desk. Yeah. And she's kind of writing and you know, reading on, and sort of working at her desk amongst all these kind of like bookshelves. And, you know, it's a really lovely interior scene. I was really inspired by that sense of movement and kind of the humanity of somebody, because often a painting or a portrait, like a photograph, can often sort of distill somebody into a very kind of single moment. But what I like about Hambling's paintings is you feel like you're there. It's very cinematic. You feel like the individual's actually like in motion in front of you, alive and vibrant and vital. Yeah. And yeah, and I really like what you were saying earlier, like the cigarettes and the wine and that kind of sense of spirit. There's a really amazing photograph of Hambling in the collection as well, where you see her kind of very strongly looking to the lens of the camera and just holding a glass of wine as if to say, yes, like this is
about that. It feels like, yes, she's looking to the camera, but it feels like she's wearing, even though her clothes is like a blouse and a softer cut suit jacket, it feels very masculine in her pose. She feels very kind of proudly standing there. But what you'll notice is this glass, it feels very Hitchcockian, because behind her, the glass has been magnified to this huge glass. So in her hand, it looks small and dainty, but in reality, I think what it's projecting is the fact of how much she loves her wine and how important it is to her. And it has this shadow, but that was photographed in 1988, which I found quite inspiring about that year, is the same time that Damien Hirst had organized the Freeze exhibition that was happening. It was the same year. So you've got this kind of narrative going on of the young contemporary artists just kind of fertilizing. And then this artist that's been there, the language she's created has been there through art history for this period in British art history, and standing there very proudly like, I'm here, what are you going to bring to me? And you know, just around the corner that new movement of art's happening.
I think Hambling for me always represented this real strength of character that was incredibly inspiring. Like, it's a message that she doesn't necessarily explicitly shout out, but just by the way she looks into the lens and the way that she dresses and the way that she holds herself as a kind of artistic persona reeks of kind of like self-confidence, this message of kind of be yourself, no matter, you know, if the world doesn't agree with you, it's okay to be you. And I think that's such a powerful message. And it's definitely one that's shared with some of the other artists we're going to talk about today as well.
Absolutely. Do you know how many portraits Maggie Hambling is sitting in the National Portrait Collection?
No, how many?
15. And do you know how many portraits she has contributed to the National Portrait Gallery?
No.
13. Wow, so I've got these statistics as we go throughout this chat. So that's quite an interesting.
You're such a geek, Russ. I love that about you.
I am a complete geek. So shall we go on to Howard Hodgkin?
Yeah. Can I say one more thing quickly about Hambling?
Yeah.
One of those works you mention in the collection, one of those 13 actually made by her, is of a talk art guest, Stephen Fry.
Yes.
And I love this. It's like a charcoal kind of drawing. And I think she proposed a number of different works and they chose that one. And the reason I love that one is the bow tie in it looks like two people talking. So it's almost like some kind of representation of like who Stephen Fry is, as like a performer and an actor. The whole kind of embodiment.
Conversationalist, isn't it? He's a conversationalist, isn't he?
Yes.
I guess, and she's kind of enhancing that. But it feels very typically Maggie Hambling. It's like that's her line, and you can recognise it. And it's very caricatured, but I know that Stephen loves it, and it's a really good energy that she's captured of him in a simple line drawing.
And there's a side to Stephen as well, like as a kind of LGBTQ plus kind of hero.
Absolutely.
I think Stephen's so, what I love about him is the way that he openly talks about his mental health and like feeling sad, and also the kind of intense, geeky kind of knowledge and the way he reads books and loves words. And I think that portrait of him really sums up the multifaceted kind of emotional complex dimension within him, because he's so many different kind of elements. And he's such a unique human, and I think that should be celebrated.
Amazing. Right, let's go on to Howard Hodgkin. How many portraits has Howard painted that's in the MPG?
I'm going to guess. How many pictures of him?
How many has he made?
How many has he made? Maybe seven?
Oh, no, sorry. No, sorry. How many portraits are there of Howard Hodgkin in the National Portrait Gallery?
I would say there's seven or eight.
15.
Wow, really?
And how many has he actually painted?
Or maybe drawn? Six, because I think it's quite hard to come by his work.
One,
right.
Because
yeah.
I guess they have... What's amazing about Howard Hodgkin is he's very abstracted, but they are the essence of emotion, of feelings. So they are these colour fields that are explaining the interior dialogue of someone through abstraction. So although there might not be a physical personification of someone, they are really making up what it is to be human. He's pushing out on there an absolute identity and a personality through these color fields.
Yeah, and I think what's special about Hodgkin is this kind of, you can actually see it in the photograph of him that's in the collection at the National Portrait Gallery. He had this kind of like strength of character, but he also had a kind of shyness and like quite a private world. I remember when Carl, who I worked with, he made some prints with him. And I know that when he went to the studio, Howard used to invite people into the studio, but unlike many other artists where you like get to see all the work they're working on, he would turn all the canvases facing the wall and all you'd see is the back of the canvas, so he wouldn't actually let you see anything. And then if you were going to meet him about a project, he would bring out the single work that you were collaborating on and show you that one piece. So he was very private and kind of, it's not secretive as such, but I think he really respected his privacy. And it was very special to kind of protect that interior world and like not just to kind of constantly be, you know, letting people into it. So it's quite an interesting thing.
Yeah, I feel like that comes from his, you know, what happened in his life, the choice he made at an early age. He always knew he was gay, but again, it was at a time when it was less accepting societally, but also of oneself. And he then got married to a woman and has two children that are still around and had this life with a woman. And I'm sure it was very incredibly happy and they had a nice time, but he always knew in himself that he wasn't being authentic to himself and he was being dutiful to what the social contract was of the time. So I feel like when he was able to come out, like when he died, he had a lover of 20 years he'd lived with. So he'd had this real gay, authentic lived life. But I feel like it was even more precious to him because the time that he wanted to have experienced that, he couldn't, because he was married and he was loyal to his wife in a heterosexual relationship. But it feels like the portraits that were made during that time are really telling of his kind of psychosomatic emotions, and they would channel out. Like there was a work in 1977 called Red Man, called Jealousy, and it's like this coiled anger of like this just round and round again, and you just feel like that's like a lot of this was his emotions coming out, or his kind of what he wanted to do so badly but couldn't.
And actually that portrait of him, there's a photograph of him, a black and white bromide print that was taken in 1970, and it's by Edward Lucy Smith. And I think in that one, you really get that sense of all of that narrative you're discussing there, and that kind of, he looks quite brooding. And then, and behind him, there's a painting, like, you know, leaned up against the wall. But I love that kind of intensity he had in his stare. And it's so wonderful to have this kind of archive of photography that's, you know, parallel to the actual artwork he made. And in the art that he made, like his paintings, I've always loved them because of this sense of memory and those kind of very intimate moments, a bit like you're talking about with jealousy there. But if you think of like loving somebody, it's not just the actual, you know, you don't always remember their face. You might remember a smell or a touch or the light coming in through the window. And I really think his paintings captured that. And there was a really great show at the National Portrait Gallery a number of years ago, which were, it was a portraits show, and it was called Absent Friends. And I remember going to it thinking like, but hang on a minute, Howard Hodgkin makes abstract paintings. Like, how are these portraits? And through that exhibition, I really began to understand that through color and, you know, gesture and, you know, putting your finger into paint and applying it to a canvas or a frame, because he often painted onto the frames, yeah, that can be a portrait of somebody. Like, all of those elements can sum up your experience of loving someone or being a friend of someone or companionship. And what I like about him is that, as a queer artist, as a gay artist, it's kind of using these different ways of representation. So it's not just the figurative idea or a kind of literal exploration of a human being. It's actually this kind of wider, you know, more about kind of those personal, intimate moments.
Essence. It's the essence of, yes, someone. And I've got to say that that photograph, he looks incredibly handsome.
I know.
And I like the fact that we only see a section of the painting, but my projection onto it is I feel like that painting that's specifically been chosen for that portrait is loaded with messaging, is loaded with things that is very personal to him that we may never know, but thoughts and feelings, people, a single person, who knows, someone he had a crush on, in love with, I don't know. But I like the idea that this painting's there and you'll never know the crypticness of why it's been placed there and why he chose that specific one. But I like the idea that it is telling us something without realizing.
Yeah. I also love the paintings because they kind of make me feel about an imprint or a kind of a memory, which I said before, but it's also this kind of, just think of the word, hang on. It's almost like if you get up in the morning and you've been in bed together and there's like an imprint of someone's head in a pillow. Like that's, it's those kind of moments that his paintings really recall for me and sort of bring up these really like private, intimate times.
Yeah. Intimacy. And apparently he was a nightmare to interview because he didn't like to talk about any of his work. So in reality, I was thinking I would love to have interviewed Howard Hodgkin for Talk Art, but it feels like that would never have happened anyway.
There's a really amazing documentary about him where they traveled to India with him because he was really inspired by the colors and the culture and, yeah, like the pigments and the food and all of the kind of Indian culture. And loads of it is just him being filmed looking. And that idea of looking was so important to him. And he would absorb all of the kind of experiences around him without a notepad, without anything written down, no camera. It was all just his brain remembering. And then he'd go back and they'd show him in the studio in England, painting these paintings that become like exact kind of memories of that looking, that intense stare. And I love that. I think it's amazing.
Wow. Amazing. Howard Hodgkin, legend. Right, we're going to go on to now someone that we both know and love, Isaac Julian.
Yeah, I love Isaac.
So how many portraits are in the collection?
Oh, God, you and your numbers.
Gosh.
I don't know, maybe four?
Three. Very good. Very close.
You should win a prize for that.
Should. I'll give you a portrait prize. So there is three photographs there. And the first one that we were looking at was from 1993. And in this one, I think he's a lot younger, but he looks very cheeky. He's kind of staring a bit up. And I feel like there is the twinkle that when you meet Isaac, you get this twinkle. He's very cheeky. I think he's got a great sense of humor. He likes to laugh. He likes to gossip, I think. Maybe that's me gossiping, saying he wants to gossip. But my feeling on his feels like he likes to gossip. And that picture really sums up this kind of cheeky, kind of queerness that he's got that I really embrace.
It's also by an artist called Robert Taylor, a photographer called Robert Taylor. And there's something about that era, like the way it's black and white, it kind of really brings to mind the whole kind of like, you know, even things like in the mainstream culture at the time, like Madonna's Vogue video, that kind of like black and white, you know, classic kind of Hollywood shot or something. And he's got a real mischievous kind of look and spark and light in his eyes. That it's such a simple photo, but it really captures so much of who he is. I think it's a really impressive, impressive photo.
Yeah, there's a second one, is from 2002, which is lit from one side, where he's a bit more mature, and he's very, I think he's quite sexy in this one. I think he's quite brooding and knowing, and I think he's on a really good trajectory and knows himself more and the work and what the work is saying. And I like that confidence that's in that one.
And there's a great photo of him in front of two of his works taken by Horace Ove, who's a complete legend.
Yeah. He's got a Guinness World Record for being the first Black British filmmaker to direct a feature-length film, which is called Pressure, Horace Ove. And that was painted, that was photographed in front of a series that Isaac did called Baltimore, which was three screens that played the same shot from different angles of this movie that was set in Baltimore, and the three institutions in Baltimore shared the show, because Isaac predominantly makes work for museums, for institutions, for galleries. So whenever he creates a body of work, it's specifically for an institutional space.
Yeah, and actually I really like his approach to making work, because again, I think it's very complex, and he uses like huge video screens, you know, film, photography, all these different elements. Sound is really important. And I just think he's a really important person, and there's a kind of tenderness in his work. And I really loved the early work that was his breakthrough kind of piece about the Harlem Renaissance. And Langston Hughes, and like
looking for Langston, that was cool. But you know what is super gay about this? Obviously, it was about a guy who was secretly gay at the time and used a lot of coding that he borrowed from Walt Whitman, where he would appropriate the initials of someone's name with numbers to kind of cryptically put them in, which Walt Whitman took, which then David Hockney also used that in his earlier paintings.
Right.
He used this kind of coding, this coding that queer people could use to hide their attractions. But Looking for Langston was the inspiration for which pop star's music video, Rob, which is super gay.
God, trying to think. Is it George Michael?
Mm-mm. Close, kind of. Same period, obviously.
I thought maybe it would be Outside or something. Who else? Pet Shop Boys?
No.
They're all my heroes. Madonna?
Your hero.
Although Madonna, I guess she wasn't queer herself.
It was Madonna.
Was it Madonna?
It was for Vogue.
Oh, so for Vogue, yeah.
The way that that Looking for Langston was shot, David Fincher saw that and Madonna saw that. And then for the music video for Vogue, which is gay history, queer history, changed the game. That was all inspired by the way that Isaac Julian shot that movie, Looking for Langston.
And also Madonna's dancers, they came out of that whole kind of ballroom New York club scene. And, you know, they were actually part of the Paris is Burning film. And I know that was a big influence on Madonna as well, I think she even went down to some of the clubs at that time.
Yeah,
but that's interesting, because that's what I'm saying about that photo that's in the National Portrait Gallery collection, is because there's something about like film noir and kind of like this really like elevated, dreamy, staged perfection or something. You know what I mean? Like the lighting and the staging of these photos and that Madonna video, actually, it's so kind of like soft lighting, and it's really Hollywood kind of glamour, but, you know, taken to the kind of underground club scene. It's such a brilliant combination of elements.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Art, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
Yeah, totally. So I think he's just phenomenal and really an amazing talent, and what an incredible figure of queer history. But what's I find kind of really kind of meta now that I love is that Isaac Julian made a lot of work about overlooked queer black icons, and he has now become not overlooked but himself a queer black icon. And through making the work where he brings these people to light, he has also established himself as a really important voice and an advocate for a huge community.
So, and you know what else? It's like the legacy of Isaac Julian's work, I think, is so key, because right now there's a whole new movement of really talented black artists across like different disciplines. So whether it be like filmmakers, music, art, you know, photography. And I think so many of the people that we've spoken to cite him as an influence. There's something about the kind of immersive ambition, the cinematic scale of it, that's inspired a whole new generation. And a lot of the work you're seeing now is 100% influenced by what Isaac has kind of given people permission to go out and do in a way.
Yeah, well, what he's done is he's broke down barriers between all the art practices, and that's what he completely channels and forges ahead. And that's inspiring to younger artists when it feels like you're told stay in your lane. Whereas Isaac's saying, like, no, cross all the lanes and make the best story you can and make it authentic and true. So I think
we love, isn't it, a talk art, like breaking down boundaries between disciplines, and also this idea of like high and low, and like, you know,
hierarchy.
It was maybe like a TV presenter in the 80s is just as important as someone who's got a show at the Royal Academy. It's like, it's really important to like listen to all different people's experiences with art and how it can transform all of our lives in different ways.
I think with art, it's what we're trying to do is break down the hierarchy. No art practice, no artist, no someone who's into art is any important than anyone else. It's all about artists for everyone, and everyone getting something from it, or making it, or being in it. And that feels really exciting.
Great.
Right. Final guest is...
I love this. Final guest.
Our final guest is the legend, our hero, our biggest hero, David Hockney.
He's our hero though, Russ. He's also become a friend of yours lately.
Yeah, yeah. We've been emailing a bit, but that's exciting. Anyway, so how many portraits has he sat for in the National Portrait Gallery?
I bet you there's loads of David Hockney, because the great thing about Hockney is he was actually supported by institutions really early on. And I think he was one of the people, I sometimes see Hockney as a kind of Trojan horse somehow. It's like he somehow took queer politics, gay kind of agenda into the mainstream.
Yes.
So kind of effortlessly and geniusly, like people sort of just accepted what he was doing much faster than other eyes. So I reckon there's probably like 17 pictures of him in the collection.
49 he sat for. Yes, and I'm trying to find the link now to find how many he's made, and I've completely lost it. Have you got that link, Rob?
I'm sure I can find it.
Or just look on the MPG page for Hockney and how many he's actually contributed. So Hockney has sat himself for 49 portraits, and he has contributed 14 portraits that are now part of the National Portrait Gallery collection. Isn't that amazing?
It's so amazing and so brilliant. The thing about Hockney is, I'm not surprised there's like 49 portraits, photographs of him, because he was such a fascinating persona. Like, he's pretty much up there with, like, I don't know, you think of all the great artist personas like Andy Warhol, but even people like Frida Kahlo, who kind of, you know, really took care about the way they present themselves and the way that they would choose clothes to kind of express their interior worlds. And, you know, even down to like the fine details, like his glasses, like the shape of his glasses. There's an amazing photo, like a black and white photo of him looking through this big magnifying glass. It's by Godfrey Argent from 1969. And again, you've got that concept of like looking, you know, he's obviously looking at a painting or something with this huge magnifying glass. But, and also his hair and like his knitwear. I'm obsessed with his knitwear. He's like my fashion hero. Like even this jumper I'm wearing today, I probably would never have bought if I hadn't been obsessed with David Hockney when I was a kid.
I love the fact that there's a few black and white photographs. There's one from 1977, one from 1969. And they're really fun. He's so cheeky. And he was making work that was outwardly queer at the time, really proudly. Again, at another time in history when it was a lot harder to live an authentic life in that way. And they're so performative. He's jaunty and twinkly and cheeky and so, he seems so happy, you know. And I think there's an amazing painting in there from 1970. Oh, no, sorry, that's a photograph. Tell about. So there's a photograph in there from 1970 by Cecil Beaton.
Yes! I love that one.
It's just like, and that one, he has his glasses off.
Yeah.
And I think you don't really see Hockney with his glasses off a lot, because they became, you know, they're his trademark. It's a bit like Alan Bennett. You never see Alan Bennett with his glasses off. I always see like they're from the same part of the world. They both wear these kind of spectacles. They're known for their accents, and you know, Alan Bennett, another queer absolute hero, and I feel like Hockney is a queer hero, but this image of him with his glasses off is really raw and tender, because I feel like he's really revealing a side of himself that we don't know, because everything else I have seen in these photographs that we've been discussing feels very performative, and he's in control of how we see him and how he wants.
The Cecil Beaton shoot, there's a number of different photos from that photo shoot. And there's one where Hockney's just been painting the work, Mr. and Mrs. Clark and Percy, where you've got like the white cat sat on Mr. Clark's lap. Mm-hmm. And I remember that painting because Raven Smith, the cultural commentator and writer, we interviewed him on Talk Art, and he was another person like us from a similar generation who, when we were kids, was like obsessed with the work of Hockney, and somehow Hockney kind of gave us all permission to feel like it was okay to be ourselves. But what I like about that photo of Hockney, kind of, you see his back and he's wearing this kind of like Missoni style, very intensely knitted jumper. And it's really thoughtful and reflective and quite vulnerable, actually, because he's got his hands, like he's sort of holding his hands behind his back. And it's a really unusual, captivating portrait. And I love that we have all these kind of documentation of these very private moments. So you get a sense of what it was like and the humanity behind Hockney. Because I think sometimes when an artist becomes so successful and iconic and the work is so good, you can kind of just put them up on this pedestal as if they're like these giants. But actually, you know, he was actually just sitting there with a paintbrush in the studio, you know, making all these works in a very private, intimate way. And I think Cecil Beaton had a real knack for capturing those kind of off-guard, touching human moments.
Hang on, Rocky. Sorry, Rocky's just barking.
Rocky agrees.
Hang on, Rock. Shush. Shush, Rocky. I also like that in a lot of these images, you see David Hockney paired with one of his artworks.
Yes.
Like, there's two sides to this. I love the fact that you now know what these artworks are and what collection they're in and what their history has been. And there he is freshly in the studio making them. But I also like the fact that he's painted alongside them because he doesn't want to separate himself from the artwork. He is a personality. He was becoming famous. He was becoming well-known as the figure of David Hockney, recognisable. But he's also like, I am the artist, David Hockney. Do not separate me from my art. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, and actually there's an amazing painting in the National Portrait Gallery collection called Self-Portrait with Charlie, and it's from 2005, so it's a more kind of recent work in a way. And he's actually stood there in the painting himself. He's standing there in front of a canvas, and you can kind of see the back of the canvas, and then he's got these two very big kind of yellow paintbrushes in his hand, and he's looking directly into, you know, what would be the camera. And you feel like you're getting this kind of behind the scenes experience of what it's like, you know, for him to be making the painting, but actually then painted by himself. And it's depicting a guy called Charles, who I think is a friend of Hockney's. And he's an American author.
He was Hockney's art assistant in the 80s.
Oh, was he? Charles Davis? Yes. Yes.
Yeah, he's an author and an artist. And it was his assistant. So this painting is like the original selfie. He's taken, it's almost like there's an iPhone there just like held above him. But you think of that time in the 80s and Charles is queer and David's queer. And you think, you know, that was a time in queer history where the community was decimated by AIDS and HIV. But you also think of the stories, the fun that them two must have had, the cheekiness they must have had, what life must have been like. And I think Hockney was probably living in LA at that time, or was he living in the States? I don't know, but you just imagine the life lived and the stories that those two will have. And there's obviously a reason why he's put Charlie in this portrait with him, because Charles, I'm making him like, I'm going shorthanded with him, I don't know him, but it's called Charlie. But you know that Charles and him, there is something genuine and important about this friendship, about this.
Yeah. And it's interesting because this painting is actually from 2005. And what it does is it shows the importance of friendships and queer friendships, and also friendships with kind of, you know, even straight people, but how you can have that kind of like solidarity and like, you know, mutual understanding somehow, and like strength from different communities. And I think this idea of friendships long-term and how often sitters will reappear later in works, and you get to see a kind of aging process, both of Hockney himself, but also of the people that sit for him. I love that kind of tender exchange of friendship. You know, and that's been a big part of what I think Talk Art has taught me about me and you, is our own kind of gay, queer friendship, and the way that we kind of help each other to grow and to support each other as we get older. It's a really sweet thing. And also, I love he's wearing this navy kind of dark blue shirt, and then he's got these bright red braces, you know, really like traditional ones, almost kind of like country style. But I love that kind of way that his style is so
all to about him. The fashion, all about the fashion. But in the way that Maggie Hambling has coded her paintings as Howard Hodgkin, they're an interior, authentic life that's been channeled through them. Hockney is also an artist that throughout his whole career has relied on the codes that are personal to him to send a message out there subliminally to his community, but to everybody. So it went mainstream, but unbeknownst to people, they're witnessing a part of gay history. They're witnessing a queer narrative. They're witnessing a queer secret or story, and they're not privy to it. And I love that about his work, because it's very cheeky and very kind of...
You know what? That is a theme. You recently acted in a show written by Russell T. Davis called Years and Years, which had an amazing kind of queer storyline in it that you yourself were part of. But his most recent TV show that's just out at the moment, It's a Sin, I'm obsessed with, because yes, it shows the harshness and the brutal reality of the HIV and AIDS epidemic and pandemic back in the 70s, 80s. But it also shows that kind of sense of fun and the kind of joy that the friendships and the bonds and the, you know, the connection that all of that community had at that period of time. And I think that sense of joy and love and care for each other can often get lost in the kind of sadness and the trauma and the drama of, you know, the fact that so many people died. And often what gets remembered is the kind of darkness and the kind of the sad trauma of it all. But what I think is important to remember is the human soul and this idea of like joy and celebration and connection and sexuality and fun, and also braveness and boldness and attitude. And it really comes out in that TV series. I think it's really impressive. And that's definitely aligned with Hockney's work too.
Yeah. So there's another portrait, which is an etching, which was part of an edition as a fundraiser for 1971 called Richard, Jim and Felix. And it feels very hippie. And yeah. I went, these just look like hippies, but this is like 1971. So it's the end of the 60s going into the 70s.
It's almost like kind of Joni Mitchell, Woodstock, yes. Like, you know, nudity, like it's okay to be naked. Yeah,
exactly. But what's the irony of that is that you've got these three nude men, and they were three editors that worked on a magazine called Oz, which at the time was really trailblazing. Political satire, but also really allowing a dialogue about, you know, nudity, about embracing, you know, drugs, about like smoking pot. Not, I don't think they did the hard stuff, but I think when it came to just that hippie mentality, and a lot of people were very anti-hippie, they hated hippies, and that this magazine stood for something. But what happened was is that they were sent to prison finally, but they were put, there was a trial for obscenity laws, because on the cover of one of the magazines, they were showing, I think it's themselves or someone else urinating against a work of art by someone. And everyone was in uproar, and there was this obscenity law that was being crossed, and they were tried for it. So as a fundraiser, Hockney made this image of the three editors with their dicks out to raise funds for this obscenity law case that was being launched to them, which I find really ironic. And again, shows you the cheekiness of Hockney. He's like, well, I'm going to make something obscene, but it's an artwork. And I am, as you said, the Trojan horse that's able to do this work and put it out there and it'd be seen as fine art. But I'm also really pushing obscenity. We're seeing nude men with their bits out, and I'm making it in an edition. So there's going to be more than one, and you can buy it, and the money from it is going to help these people with the obscenity law. I love that.
And the thing about Hockney is he's so skilled. He's like the best draftsman ever. And the way that he draws and etches is like second to none. So also, they're just amazing portraits. You know, even outside of the whole social history and the political kind of content, they're actually just incredible portraits of human beings. And I think, you know, even now, it's really interesting the resistance that so many people have to the human body, when we all have one, we all know what each other's bodies look like, you know, to an extent. And it's like really shocking to me, actually, how so many people are kind of up in arms and can be so, you know, shocked and offended by the human body.
That's what we have. That's who we are. But yet I find it fascinating. I find it, you know, it is ridiculous in some ways, but I find it fascinating that we all do. There is still the ability to shock by the naked body.
And like we just interviewed a queer artist called Robert Andy Coombs, who's paraplegic. He's in a wheelchair, and he makes photographs using his mouth to actually like activate the camera. And he spends ages thinking about the exact shot that he wants. And, you know, when you think of him, and there's this whole kind of like uproar and outrage about a lot of his imagery and his artwork, when actually it's just a human body, you know, and I love him for that. I love the way that he loves his own body and that he's, you know, happy to explore these themes, which are still in, you know, the year we're living in now, 2021, that they're still provocative. It's
quite mind-blowing that we still have the ability to shock just by our own bodies. And it's like 2021. And like, not since Adam and Eve have we been allowed to walk around with our bits out and not be like, it's like terrible, like a shocking thing. But I think that's fascinating with art, and especially queer art, that there are so many stories still to be told. There's so many queer stories. And you're talking about Robert Andy Coombs, who's a disabled queer artist, but from all communities, whoever they are, within all the subcultures of what it is to be queer, there are so many narratives that are still missing from the gallery walls and need to be there and need to be represented. Because until you're represented on gallery walls, until you're represented in culture, it's easy to be overlooked and to be told you don't really exist.
Yes.
And some stories still need to be told. So these four artists we've talked about today are trailblazers for the queer story, for showing an authentic queer life lived. But there are still so many missing.
I know. And actually, that's also why I'm really grateful that we're able to do talk art, because I feel like slowly we're getting to learn more about all these different narratives, whether they be like, you know, from trans artists or, you know, so many different kinds of experiences. And I also think, you know, liberation and human rights are going to continue to be a real concern, and we have to make sure we protect, you know, the human rights and equal rights for women and for queer people and, you know, for trans people. It's a really important thing, and, you know, you cannot get kind of complacent about it, you know, thinking that, oh, of course we're all equal. I think you have to keep these conversations in the forefront of culture. And also, I love that artists are able to document the now, you know, what's happening in society right now, and to have those moments like, you know, Oz magazine, or, you know, we can now look back and see that moment distilled in an artwork, and it touches us. You know, I think it's a really important document.
Amazing. Well, this has been an absolute pleasure talking to you today, Rob, for Talk Art and the National Portrait Gallery. We hope that you go...
Are there any portraits of you in the National Portrait Gallery?
Yeah, there is actually. There is one. Yeah. That is, we were in the History Boys when we did a group shot when we were doing the History Boys play. We are all with Alan Bennett, photographed, and I cannot remember the artist. I don't know if you can look it up quickly.
I found it. Yeah, I've just found it. It's... it says Russell Tovey, sitter, 1981. There you go. It's by Derry Moore, the 12th Earl of Drogheda.
So Derry Moore, what year was it? 2004?
It's 2004, and it's a bromide print. And it's got you and James Corden and the whole cast. It's really cool, actually. It's a beautiful photograph.
Yeah, so I have. I have been a sitter. I am a sitter.
In it as well. You've got like, you're doing like a side pose like that, cheeky.
Yeah, I'm unsure of my side pose. But that was photographed in 2004 by Derry Moore. And I remember being in one of the offices at the National Theatre on the top floor, and we all posed for that photograph. And that is now in the National Portrait Gallery with Alan Bennett, the queer legend icon. And
well, I actually really like the National Portrait Gallery website as well, because every time we interview people, I often go on there and search, because it's a way of like finding out someone's kind of journey through life. Like when we interviewed Ian McKellen, I remember going on there, and there are loads of amazing portraits of him through the ages. And there was an amazing one where he had like a really sexy kind of moustache. And I was like, oh my God, Ian was really attractive. I never sort of thought of him like that, but it's really funny. I love it. Yeah. We need to get a picture of you in there, babe.
Yeah, well, I'm really happy I'm in there. But for everyone watching this, thank you so much for watching this. And please get onto National Portrait Gallery website and look at their collection, and you'll be surprised at how many portraits there are of individuals, but how many portraits there are of incredibly powerful, queer, important voices throughout history. And thank you very much for having us today. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, National Portrait Gallery. Talk Art Podcast loves you.
Bye, everyone.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.